irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Yeah, Wake Up Hollywood!
Hello, sir.
I'm here with my good friend Josh Ledoux.
How you doing? It's been a bit.
Mr. First Place in our fantasy football league.
No.
Yeah, I think you're in first place.
No.
I think you're in first place.
You're wrong about
Who's
that.
Who's in first place?
I don't know. I got like 90 points this week.
Oh.
Not even close.
Did you lose last week?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I lost last week, too. I'm in 12th place.
Well, I got killed.
The NFL kind of, you know, started its thing, and I was a little disappointed with all your favorite players. I got Tom Brady, Gronkowski. They played the worst
bad.
That I've seen ever.
And the team's hurt. Edelman's out.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they're definitely not going to repeat.
A little nervous. But we'll Tom brings it together.
He always, you know what? He turns it up right at game eight. From game eight, and it's like, oh yeah, we got to start playing, and then all of a sudden they get to the Super
Bowl. I was hoping they were still going to come back. I mean, they're a comeback team; they always come back in the second half. But
they just got outplayed.
Yeah,
and I was so bummed because I was like, this is the first time I've had Tom Brady on my fantasy team.
Yeah,
and I was like, oh, big points.
It didn't pay to pick him early.
He was my first draft.
I know.
It was like, because last year I got the first pick and I got Antonio Brown and he was good.
Yeah.
But man, I was like, Tom Brady is like racking up the points. He had the most points, or like top five.
Yeah.
So I was like, my boy, he's going to come in strong. And no, it was like,
yep.
It was bad. It was bad.
I had Odell Beckham Jr. who didn't play because of his ankle.
And
he was like my first pick. And so hopefully he'll be in next week. But
I had Adrian Peterson who got 5 points.
Yeah.
5 points. And you see him like arguing with the coach, like he's gonna be the third string guy in the Saints. It's just sad. It's he used to be so dominant and then
whoever had Hunt got like 50 fantasy points.
I know.
That's crazy.
Which is crazy. Yeah. So how have you been, man? I haven't seen you in a while.
Not too bad. You know, I'm pretty happy I didn't move to Florida yet.
Yeah. I mean, dude, Irma.
I know, and I could have been there. I was supposed to move in August, so.
Dude, see? Yeah. See? That's a sign. Got to stay in Cali, man.
It's pretty crazy.
Well, you know, did you see any of the footage of, like, the Cuba, like what's going on over there?
The Caribbean islands are just, like, destroyed.
I heard, like, the Virgin Islands are, like, wiped out.
Yeah.
And, like, 90% of the homes in Florida are really kind of screwed up. It's sad.
Well,
it's
down, really sad. I guess down south, like, Miami and Key West got hit pretty bad, but the rest of the state wasn't too bad. And I talked to my friends this week, and they're saying they might be out of power for 2 weeks.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that's going to suck. And they lost their fence. Their whole fence was wiped
just
out.
Just gone.
Yeah.
And you know what's crazy? Like, people said, like, their cars and their homes, everything they owned. I was like trying to think, like, what would I take with me in that situation?
I don't know. Your dog. That's it.
Yeah.
Pick up the dog and go.
Yeah. Just go. I'd probably get a guitar, you know? But it's so funny. It's like, I was like, okay, she can take one guitar. She, I'm like trying to map out what they can take of mine.
I mean, the only thing I'll say is at least they have a warning when they're going to get a hurricane. Here, if the big one
earthquake,
ever does come, we're going to have zero warning.
I know. But you know what? I'd still rather be in an earthquake any day of the week. Hurricane? I don't know. Like, water, man, you can't mess with water. When water floods into your streets.
But when that 9.0 hits, you'll be praying that hurricane instead.
Yeah, the gas lines. I mean, all the prep that I've just been reading about for the earthquakes, I'm like, I don't want to do that. It means so much.
And all my friend went to buy plywood. Sold out everywhere.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Plywood's all sold out. So they just had to see what happens.
And you know what? What the craziest thing is, I saw this story. This is really sad. So you remember when Hurricane Sandy hit New York?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was this, all New York and New Jersey, there were all these homes that were paying FEMA for flood insurance.
Oh, yeah.
And these insurance people would come over and do reports.
Yeah.
Right? and then they would send the report to FEMA, and somebody between the organization and FEMA, there were all these little insurance companies, would doctor the reports.
Crazy.
So people that would say, oh, there's structural damage, they would get a third of what they were supposed to get. So if they were supposed to get $250,000 for a new home,
yeah,
they'd get $70,000. They'd be in debt. And they'd be like, what do you mean? I've been paying my insurance
right.
this whole time.
Flood insurance is really not meant for hurricanes and stuff in most cases. Like, people think they're getting it for that reason, but it's really like if a pipe burst, you know, that's what it's – because acts of God are not usually covered by insurance.
But if you get flood insurance through FEMA –
Yeah, different.
It's a
special
part.
But I'm just saying, these
part.
People that thought they were covered because they had flood insurance, but it wasn't like hurricane insurance. You know, you need,
I mean,
like,
I can't imagine. I got a little pissed when I was watching this. I'm like, you know, everybody pays insurance for cars or homeowners insurance or renters insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I've got all kinds of insurance. And when you really need it, they're not there. You know what I mean? It's like, for the most part, they're not there. I've had good experiences so far.
Yeah.
But when I heard this story, I mean, I couldn't imagine losing a home with all the stuff.
For some people, that's everything.
And it was six feet of water. And, like, the whole home had been moved off the foundation.
Yeah.
And then they got a report like, oh, there wasn't, you know, structural damage. It's like, what do you mean? My entire home is off the foundation. You can't live in it.
It's ridiculous. It's scary.
And you know what's crazy? It's like half the people on this in this one city in Jersey, they just basically had to abandon their homes. And it's like they're all living in debt now. And these insurance companies are a joke. It's like, so I just, like, you know, when I see things like Irma and Houston.
Yeah,
you know,
Houston
it's
is
like
really bad.
Harvey. It's Harvey and Irma, right?
Yeah. And Jose, like, is out in the coast right now in the Atlantic. They don't know where that's going.
Really?
Yeah.
There's never been two Category 4 hurricanes in this close proximity.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
And it's like, anybody that doesn't believe in global warming, I hope they get their shit together and start believing, because it's ridiculous. Even the Pope is like, guys, we got to start believing in global warming. It's crazy. So, yeah, but I just really feel for all those families if they have – most don't have flood insurance at all. So they're definitely going to be screwed.
Yeah.
But the ones that even do have flood insurance, when they have an engineer come over. And so what happened in the story, the engineer, he came back because the company said, you need to go back. And so the homeowner was like, how could you put this report? He's like, that's not my report. So he went into his car and pulled out his report. He's like, this is what I sent them. And it said structural damage. So, you know, one of the guys, like, photocopied it.
But what's the benefit to FEMA? They're getting paid off by the insurance?
Because they save like $300,000 on a home.
It's crazy.
If let's say your home has structural damage.
But FEMA's government.
Yeah, but they put money into these companies. They get, like, they're like almost like grants.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the companies get money from FEMA. So the companies, FEMA's giving them the money and then just, like, washing their hands clean of it. And then these little insurance companies, they're the ones screwing everybody over.
Crazy.
So and now it's like one of the heads of FEMA was like, yeah, I know, I've seen all these reports and we're going to change it. And by the end of the report, they're like, oh, he's now a part of the Red Cross. Like, he's working in another organization. Like, you know, it's such a big problem that people are just abandoning it. So
it's billion. I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars.
It's crazy. Yeah. So, and then here's the other thing too. So after the guy said, listen, I've got this report, I'm going to take you to court. So they go to court, and the other lawyer accuses him of stealing the report, the true report, the real report. He's like, you've been stealing. That's government property. Like
oh,
basically, it was – and he was just like, I can't believe that I'm in this situation, and this is all because of these small insurance companies. It's just like, I don't know how those guys sleep at night. You know, it's like – makes you wonder. But yeah.
Very scary.
Our hearts are with the people of Florida.
Absolutely.
And Cuba and –
Houston
Virgin Islands,
still.
Bahamas.
Yeah.
Houston's still crazy.
Yep.
It's nuts. And here we are in sunny California.
Yeah, right. It's like, oh, there's an overcast today. Jeez.
You know, I felt a little bit guilty because I looked out the door today and I was like, there's not a cloud in the sky. It's so beautiful. I'm like, and then I was just like, man, we're lucky.
Yeah.
We're lucky to live here.
Yeah.
And it sucks that.
But we pay a premium to live
yes,
here.
Yes. This is what we talk about all the time.
We definitely pay for it.
So you've been good.
I'm good. Good.
You're happy you live in California
at the moment. just until the hurricanes go away, and then
well, you know, and you know what I noticed too? It's like the weather's been a little bit more humid here.
Yeah,
have you noticed that?
Yeah, especially like 2 weeks ago, it was like super humid when it was like just sporadic
that
rain.
Never happens.
Too. I know.
It's like this is crazy.
It was
so
really crazy.
Yeah, I hope this hurricane season starts to die down. But anyways, we've got a wonderful guest tonight, And he's a world-renowned author and musician, Mr. Paul Zolo. Give it up for Paul Zolo.
Thank you.
Hold on. There it comes.
I pressed it.
Yeah, it was good. Hey, no, it was good. Our audience must be all stoners at the moment. They're like, wait, oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Those are my friends.
We just needed the sign. We need to put the applaud sign.
That's right. See, they didn't see the light. No. You know, that's half the problem. Paul, you have written some very well-known books in the music industry world. Songwriting, Songwriters on Songwriting, which you interviewed. Who are some of your favorite people that you interviewed? Just mention Rad, let's name drop, because that's,
well,
you know,
Paul,
we can do
Paul
that.
Simon was my idol growing up, so getting to talk to him, because I knew his songs inside out, so that was great. And Bob Dylan was one of my obsessions for years and forever. And Leonard Cohen and Laura Nero and Becker and Fagan of Steely Dan, who we talked about, mm-hmm. and Carole King. So many great ones.
So Brian some Wilson. Hack songwriters is what you say.
Randy Newman. I mean, it goes on and on.
And you know what? What kind of made you come up with this concept? Because it's such a great idea.
I was a songwriter. That's all I ever wanted to be since I was a kid. And I was always hungry when there'd be interviews with people I love, like Dylan or Simon, for them to ask a question about, how'd you write this song? That's all I wanted to know. How did they do that? Paul Simon looked like a normal guy to me. He had a guitar. I had a guitar.
Yeah.
How did he write Bridge Over Troubled Water? That's what I want to know.
And he did it in like 5 minutes. That's what's crazy.
Yeah. Though he wrote the third verse later.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I'm a Paul Simon nerd.
Yeah.
Admittedly.
Did you go to the Skirball exhibit?
I did.
I just went to that.
Very happy
awesome.
They quoted from my interview there.
Oh,
that's amazing.
That's awesome.
That's incredible. What was the quote from the interview?
You know, I'm not sure, but he said so many interesting things, and they used one thing there. I mean, not everyone loves to talk about the process, but he loves to.
Yeah.
So we just really connected, and I've interviewed him many, many times over the years.
I think I actually met you for the first time at the Q&A with Paul Simon at the Grammy Museum.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. Like, I'd never met Paul Simon before, and yeah, I never raised my hands for Q&As. Mm. And they were like, we're going to take some questions. And I was like, hands straight up. And I was like, you know, I went to a Q&A with Clive Davis, and they asked him what the best, greatest song of all time ever written was. And he said, Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Right. Mm.
And I said, what's the song that you wish you wrote? And he was like, you know, I never really thought.
Oh, you asked that question.
That was me. That was me. And he said, I never really thought Bridge Over Troubled Water was my song because I didn't sing it until the third verse. And he said, but the song I wish I wrote was Silent Night.
That's right.
And I was like,
interesting answer, isn't it?
I would have picked a Beatles tune, maybe a James Taylor tune. I would have thought like an Everly Brothers tune because he's huge in the Everly Brothers. So it was kind of a crazy moment. The whole time I was just like giddy as a as a schoolboy. So I'm sure you interviewing just one of these people, you must have felt like that. But you got to interview so many.
I know, it's quite a list.
That's an incredible list.
Yeah, and I always felt very privileged to be with him. I never got jaded about it. To me, to meet someone that wrote a song that the whole world knows, that's still the most exciting thing to me.
It's crazy,
and
right?
Some of these guys, you know, Tom Petty, Paul Simon, Carole King, they've written so many songs that the whole world knows. It's remarkable.
And they're just so good. You know, the songs document a moment in time, and they become timeless. You know what I mean? It's like Tom Petty was my first concert, and I recently did a festival with him at a Royal Secco at the Rose Bowl.
Nice.
Actually, Josh, you were there.
I was there. It was a great show.
And it was crazy to see Tom Petty performing again after I'd seen him in high school. And I'd seen him a couple times before, but it was just like, man, this guy is the reason that made me want to be in a band and write music. Yeah. And he's like, and then you hear how many generations of songs he's got, you know, like the decades of hit song.
It's remarkable. He started out great, and then he got even better when he did the solo stuff with Full Moon Fever and all.
Yeah.
I did a whole book with him. We did a book called Conversations with Tom Petty.
Man.
So that meant I had to go to one of his houses every Saturday.
You had to go.
It was great. You know, for a year, I just hung with him every Saturday.
Man.
It was great, yeah. But he authentically loves music more than anything. There's nothing else he'd rather do, and that's why he's done it for so many years. Where other people would want to go sailing off of St. Bart's or something, he'd rather put a drum track down, you know, work on another song, work on someone else's album, write another song, you know.
And I like that he always thinks about the details of making a record, like doing it to tape or like getting a guitar sound or like a good vocal. I mean, sometimes songwriters don't think about those things, and those details, it's what makes it for me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. Man, that's crazy. I got so many questions because I'm a songwriter too, and it's like crazy because you've interviewed all these amazing people. But let's talk about you first. What got you into music? What was the thing? What was the moment of Zen where you were like, I've got to do this with my life?
The most exciting thing was hearing the Beatles. I think the first time they came on our AM little transistor radios, the sound of that was so electric and exciting and different. And to me, there was nothing more exciting. At the same time, Simon and Garfunkel. And I just thought, you know, there's, except for maybe Astronaut, I remember as a kid, that seemed pretty cool. Nothing else seemed as cool as being a songwriter. And I was always really interested in who wrote the songs and the writing of it from an early age. So I started writing songs when I was 10. I started playing guitar and almost immediately started writing, and I had teachers that really encouraged me to keep writing.
That's awesome.
And I loved it, and I didn't write good songs right away. It took me a long time to learn.
Well, that's how it's supposed to
exactly,
be, right?
Exactly. But I got a lot of wisdom, and in Chicago there was a great scene of great folk singers and songwriters like Steve Goodman, who wrote City of New Orleans, and John Prine, and they gave me some real
He's
advice.
He's a great songwriter. He's one of my favorites,
yeah,
actually.
John Prine. Genius. And, you know, there was a very high bar, you know, those guys, you know. So I had, you know, some great advice. I'd bring my songs to people backstage in Chicago, and they'd listen. And they'd,
that's crazy.
They'd tell me, you know.
And did you get influenced by the heavy blues scene over there, or were you just more into the writing, the folk, the
Yeah,
rock?
I was more in the folk music scene. I was a white kid in the suburbs, you know. But when I
what city did you actually grow up in?
Well, I was right outside of Chicago in the suburbs of Wilmette, right outside of Chicago. It's just, you know, it's like as close as North Hollywood to Hollywood.
Right.
But the blues scene's more about the South Side. I got into that later. But the folk music scene, I really got into because my dad was into Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. And they just had a great scene of people there. And so I started playing those clubs, open mics, when I was a kid, you know, playing bars like when I was 14. I couldn't drink there, but I played there.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's got to make you feel cool.
I loved it. And I get heckled, you know, it was the adult dose.
Oh,
and geez. I loved it.
Yeah,
loved
especially
it.
A bunch of drunks at the bar. Yeah, they're going to heckle you.
I
sure.
always loved hecklers. I always enjoyed it since I was young.
How did you handle it as a 14 year old kid?
Jokes, humor. You know, it's the only way. I learned really early on that if I told jokes, if you didn't tell jokes, they would tune you out immediately.
Right.
But if you're funny between songs, they would pay attention. So I used to do that, too.
That's funny. That is funny. I mean, pun intended. But that's crazy. Okay, so you were playing in these Chicago clubs, and then did you start a band? Did you just want to just stay doing a solo songwriting thing?
In Chicago, I played mostly solo or in duos, and then I went to school in Boston. I just wanted to become a songwriter, so I studied the poetry and writing and music. And in Boston, I did a lot of street singing. You know, I was singing in the subway station and in Harvard Square, which is really good for singing, as you know, being
and
an
chess
opera
singer. Yeah. Chess playing,
chess
too.
Chess playing, but learning how to project. If you're singing without a mic out there, you know, it was actually really good.
That's where Josh is from. He's from Boston.
Oh, yeah,
I'm from Massachusetts,
I went to BU.
Yeah, very nice, very nice.
And I love Boston.
Boston's a great city.
So, you know, at Harvard Square, they have, in front of the Coop, the bookstore, they have this one archway. And if you got that archway, like at 4:30 in the afternoon, you could have it all night. With this great echo, and you can make a lot of money there.
It's amazing. That is so crazy.
So people would just, like, get there early and just camp out, basically camp out?
If you wanted to get that spot, you'd have to get there early. No one else would get there till like, nighttime, but you'd have to get there to get that good spot.
Did you ever go there, and you're like, oh, man, Stewie's got it.
Many times, and then I would just sing in the subway station or somewhere else. So I had a band in Boston, and then moved to New York not for very long. I moved there right after college, and I wanted to be where John Lennon was. And he got killed within just months of me moving.
Oh,
there,
wow.
Which really upset me because I used to go to the Dakota every day. So I went there the day, you know, after he got killed. And it really convinced me I should move to L.A. So I moved here and I've been here ever since.
Wow. Hmm.
But I since got to interview Yoko and go back there, you know, which was really intense for me to go back because he was shot right there.
Right.
And you're a Beatle lover. So
you know what? I go to Strawberry Fields every time I go to New York. I don't know what it is. But it's just like,
it's
I
communion
have to.
With John.
Yeah.
And
I walk by the Dakota. I see where he was shot. But, you know, it's just like one of those things that's just, it was a tragedy. There's like one of the world's biggest tragedies. Mm. And, you know, I was too young when it happened, but it's something that I kind of, I always just pay my respects every time I go to New York because he loved New York. New York was like his city.
It sure did.
And you know what? What's crazy is like when I did my first record, I was mastering my first record, and a friend of mine who's an engineer, he came up to, you know, into the room, and he's like, you know who's across the hall? And I'm like, no. And he's like, you're never going to guess who I'm working with. I'm like, who? And he's like, Paul McCartney. And I was like, shut up. I mean, I totally did like an Elaine Seinfeld push. I like pushed him. I was like, you're joking. And he was like, no, man. And I got to watch him. I ended up watching Paul McCartney record.
Oh, wow.
I got to talk to him about recording, vocal overdubs, string arrangements with Nigel Goodrich. And I'm just sitting there going, man, this is probably the greatest musical achievement I've ever had, and I didn't achieve anything. I'm just in the room. That's all it is. So, yeah, I'm a Beatles nut myself. And I wish that I was around when John Lennon was, you know, doing his thing in New York, because that would have been an amazing thing. And that would probably be in the same place as you. Like,
yeah,
when you go to New York and then something like that happens, you're like, it's tainted.
Yeah, and I just had come there, and the song that was his single had just come out from his album Double Fantasy, Starting Over. That was my theme song, Starting Over. And then it didn't, you know, go as I was hoping. Mm. But then I got to be friends with Yoko and go back, and that kind of gave me a completion of
that's
it.
Amazing.
Yeah, that must be so much fun to talk to her and get an inside, you know.
Yeah, she's a very misunderstood person. A lot of people dislike her. Of anybody I've ever interviewed, I think she's the most misunderstood, misliked.
Well, everyone says she broke him up.
Exactly, and I still have good friends that still believe that.
Yeah.
but it was John. I mean, John was, you know, it's like,
he made his own choices.
Right.
But there were some, let's be honest, there was one questionable thing. Like, Paul McCartney said that they were in the studio one time, and he was trying to do, like, you know, a session with the Beatles, and every time he asked John a question, he would not respond, and no verbal communication, and Yoko would speak for him. And so I was like, man, like, I'm in a band, and if that ever happened to anyone, I'd be like, I would be fuming.
He pushed those limits. You know, she was in a hospital bed in the studio for quite a while, you know? He didn't want her to be home, so she was in the bed there. And okay. But they were in love, and as she said, she didn't just inspire my song, she inspired me.
Right.
You know, and Imagine, that came out of her poetry, a world beyond war. And she, you know,
she's a pretty loving being, you know, so that's awesome.
To this day,
So when did you meet her? What year did you
meet her? That was 1993.
Wow.
She was represented by Elliot Mintz, who also was Dylan's press rep, and he said, would you be interested?
And you're like, yes. I would. Did you ever interview George Martin or anybody else?
I have interviewed George Martin and Giles Martin.
And you did Ringo Starr in the new book. Yeah. So you've got two books. What are the years in difference? Like, how long did it take?
You know, the first book, Songwriters on Songwriting, came out originally, I think, 25 years ago in a smaller format. And then we kept enlarging it, adding to it. And then it got so big that it was time to do a new one. So it took about 3 years. I was actually late a couple of years with this because I kept wanting more. And so it's been over 25 years I've been doing it.
And you got some great artists. Like, Herbie Hancock's one of my favorites. Mm. And I like what you were saying. Like, oh, some people don't think he's a songwriter. Hell yeah, he's a songwriter. And he's one of the best artists and musicians of our lifetime.
Exactly.
And he will be somebody that everybody talks about, you know, for years to come.
Exactly.
So,
and when you get to talk to, I mean, he's written music. I mean, I guess some people don't, if it doesn't have lyrics, it's not a song, but it is a song.
Well, he's like, you know, the one thing that fascinates me about Herbie Hancock, it's like, he's one of the only musicians that's been a part of every musical movement. So he's been in pop, he's been in bebop, he's been in funk, he's been in kind of like, you know, he's played with Miles Davis, he's played with like Wayne Shorter and done like the fusion thing, and like he's kind of
Joni Mitchell stuff.
Yeah,
he did.
Yeah. So it's just like he's always had his hand in like the most pressing music of the time,
right?
And, you know, and it's like he's still doing that. With,
and as you know, he's just a genius when it comes to this kind of thing. And
yeah,
it's interesting to me to talk to someone like him who must know the keyboard better than, you know, 99.9% of all humans alive.
Yeah.
So I asked him, like, when you're writing on the keyboard, are you still like experimenting, like not knowing what it's going to sound like, or do you know what everything is? And he goes, oh no, man, it's endless. And I love that.
That's,
you know,
beautiful.
And when I asked,
give me chills, man.
When I asked Paul Simon the same thing, I said, Herbie Hancock said it was endless, is it that way for you? And he goes, if it's that way for Herbie, you can be sure it's that way for me.
That's awesome.
But that is the core of the thing, that even though you're a genius, you're still reaching into the unknown when you're writing music. You're still trying chords with different bass parts. And
well, you're just trying. You're trying to see what's going to work. I did a session with Greg Fillinganes, who's one of my favorite keyboardists.
He is fantastic.
And he produced Herbie, who's his idol. And I was like, man, what was that like? And he said, the first question I said to Herbie was, what's it like to play anything that comes into your imagination? You know what I mean? And it's like, he's that fluid of an artist. Like, he knows how to connect the dots. When an idea comes, it just comes through his fingers, and he knows exactly. Like, that's really rare. And you know this as a writer. It's like, I always have to experiment. Like, oh, no, that's not it. Okay, let me wait. Okay. But he just, like, it flows through him.
Absolutely.
Like,
you know,
he's just like a continuum, essentially.
Yeah, and when you get musicians at that level, that's just real magic.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no trick to that. That's the real thing,
yep.
You know?
And you see when they are inspired by each other, you know what I mean? Yeah. What was one of the biggest obstacles of interviewing all these people?
Well, the biggest obstacle is the music business and the way it's set up. The publicists, they certainly don't ever care about giving an interview for a book. So I got all these interviews for magazines. But it's a constant, you know, game to get interviews with big people. And when major songwriters would come out with an album, they would sometimes just do a few interviews. So it was almost a sport in some ways over many years to get these interviews and just be endlessly persistent.
Yeah.
I mean, I was polite pestering, I called it. But I would never give up. You know, they'd say, call us in 2 months, and I would call to that day. So that was the
good
biggest.
Good for you. Yeah. Paul, high five.
That was the biggest obstacle. But when I would get to this, the musicians, as you know, musicians speak differently to fellow musicians than to civilians.
Yeah.
So as soon as I'd let on to, like, Bob Dylan or someone, you know, I like that the song's in A minor. Suddenly, it's
this guy's a cat.
And so it opens up the conversations, and the conversations have been great. There are many times people resisted. Lou Reed actively resisted where he stood me up in L.A.
What?
Yeah, he didn't show up. We were supposed to meet. So his publicist said he's going to be in Denver in 2 nights. He's going to have dinner. You be at that dinner that night. I'm thinking, oh, God. And his tour manager said, you know, be careful. He walks out on his interviews a lot. Just be really, really careful. And don't bring up any of his old songs. And that's what I do. You know, how did you write that?
Yeah.
And as soon as I sat down with him, we started talking about Delmore Schwartz, his idol in poetry, and how that came together with rock and roll. He was talking to me about the old songs.
That's awesome.
And we talked all night, and I went to his show, you know. But, you know, a lot of journalists don't know a lot about music. They know about words, or they know about celebrity or trends. And, you know, I don't mean to put down my fellow journalists, but I do it all the time. But a lot, they don't know anything about music, a lot of it. And it's frustrating to musicians because a lot of these people, they're absolute geniuses with music, as you know well.
Yep.
Talk about Elton John or Burt Bacharach or Paul Simon.
Yep.
I mean, when it comes to Brian Wilson, just musically. But they rarely get to talk about the mechanics of music or the process of
how you write it. The finer details. And that's the stuff that makes them feel alive, you know?
And the thing that they're so proud of.
Yep.
Like in Still Crazy After All These Years by Simon, there's a real sly key change in the bridge.
Yep.
It's not like a Barry Manilow real, like, obvious key change. It's just boom. And when I mentioned that to him, I could see,
he's
very proud of that. He's like, you know how I did that? And he's like, you know, he was very happy to show me that.
Well, it's like you're like opening triggers to like, you're like, oh, let me unlock something that you've been wanting to talk about, but you don't know that you're going to be excited about this because you've done your research. And it's also like, as a musician, you do your homework. You know what I mean? You know Steve Gadd's playing drums on that. You know the people that are on the record or how he kind of like, what year he released it. And you know what I mean? It's like, so you know the details.
You know
of
that.
The questions are everything with
right.
a great interview. So it's
and,
like,
and
I'm
it,
sure they appreciate
it. It flatters
that.
The songwriter. It makes them feel good. That,
yeah.
And also that I talk about songs that aren't just their hits. So I did talk about really, you know, the hits and
the B-sides.
But there's all these guys. Tom Petty has so many amazing songs that weren't hits, but are phenomenal songs.
Yeah.
And he loves to talk about that. I bring up Two Gunslingers or Insider. It's like, yeah.
What about the She's the Girl? Is that the...
She's the One.
She's
the
One.
He wrote.
She's the One. Yeah, that soundtrack. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
And it didn't really get the push or...
That was a sad time in his life, and he didn't like to talk about it too much, but there's that song Supernatural Radio on that.
Yeah.
And also the song Walls that Lindsey Buckingham came in and did like 400 tracks. It's the most amazing harmony thing that Lindsey did on Walls.
That's crazy.
It's great. But everything Tom did was really, he was very invested.
Let's get to Paul Zolo's music right now. What are you going to play us first?
All right.
Because I could talk your ear off about this stuff. It's like...
I'm happy to talk about it, as you can probably tell.
What are you going to play us first?
I'm going to play a pretty new song. I wrote this with Dan Byrne, who's a good friend of mine and a great songwriter. And this is a song called Midnight in Nebraska. So we're playing a place here in L.A. that had a live webcast. And it, I guess it was 8 o'clock here, and someone wrote in, you know, they can write in during the show and said...
Is that Kulak's Woodshed?
Indeed. It was at Kulak's. You know Kulak's.
I played Kulak's. Awesome.
Yeah.
It's like an adult Sesame Street. Like, you walk in, it's like, This is the craziest thing ever. There's like a little tip bucket that like slides through.
That's right. It's got six moving cameras, some on little tracks.
Oh, wow.
It's so awesome.
Paul Kulak is a hero of the L.A. music scene.
Yeah.
And a lot of people know me around the country. I have a good friend in DeRidder, Louisiana, only from the Kulak's webcast.
That's crazy.
So, yeah, we were playing there, me and Dan, and someone said, it's already midnight in Nebraska, and being songwriters, we said, well, that's a song title. But it took us several months to finally write it, and we wrote it on Facebook back and forth, like the words, and it's the fastest song I've ever written. It's on his new album, which is called Adderall Holiday.
I like it already.
Choir loud, reverends in the pew, talking to parishioners with mirrors on his shoe. Trevor's in the holy park with Vicodin and crack, and books out from the library he's never taken back. It's midnight in Nebraska, high and getting higher. Midnight and everything's on fire. It's midnight in Nebraska, high and getting higher. Midnight and everything's on fire. Sister Sue's a scarecrow, Brother Bob's a bird. For Lent they gave up solid food, seven-letter words. They climb a crystal Christmas tree, foraging for food. Whatever do, whatever. I'm getting high, midnight and everything's on fire. Midnight in Nebraska, still preaching to the choir. Midnight and everything's on fire. The reverend's in the headlights. Mirrors tell the tale. There's mud and there's fresh blood on the twisted guardrail. They're mixing rye and ginger. She's there at his cheek. She bends low to hear him speak.
Very nice.
Thank you, everybody.
Crowd loves it. They had to wait for that 3-second delay, but they loved it.
There's no fade on this.
They were
thing,
taking though. It in.
That's all
they
right,
just
that's
stopped right away. They just all sit down. Okay.
We're like, hey, no more. That's it. Paul, that was awesome. Love the changes, man.
Thanks.
You have to be influenced by Cat Stevens.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure somebody has told you that before, but yeah. I definitely hear that influence.
Yeah, my whole life I've been getting that. So I used to play clubs in Chicago.
He's one of my favorites.
He would insist I play Cat Stevens, so I knew all those songs.
That's, dude, that he's like one of the fabrics of songwriting and you know,
absolutely,
as well.
Sure.
So that's a compliment. That's a very big
compliment. I know. I'm very happy to hear it. I love it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, my son, who's 17, just the other day we saw Harold and Maude, the movie that has Cat Stevens music. And he goes, you know what, Dad? you do sound like Cat Stevens. Yeah, because he's heard that, but he never really, you know, got it.
It's amazing, like the things, the influences you pull from places that you didn't know that, you know, you would pull from. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. What does your son think about all these people that you've talked to? Is that interesting to him, or is this like...
There are certain ones that he was really into, and others that he could really care less. I mean, when he was little, he used to care about everything. I could go get gas, and it's like, please take me.
right.
You know, and anything, you know? It didn't matter who it was. I'm going to go interview Odetta. Please, I want to go, you know? But there were a couple people. He wanted more than anything to meet Alice Cooper. He loved Alice Cooper.
Okay.
He saw him in Wayne's World when
That's
he was
right.
like six.
Billy Wackay.
And
right.
I took him out of school. Alice Cooper was doing a press conference downtown, and he just hung out with Alice. He just started talking to him like they were friends, my son
amazing.
And Alice. And also, he loved Rob Zombie, and we'd go see Rob Zombie a lot.
That's awesome.
And so I interviewed Rob Zombie, and he's in the book.
Oh, awesome.
And that was good.
Very
so
nice.
Because of my son, I kind of got into some music. I probably wouldn't have had in there.
Nice.
And I was actually a little scared to interview Rob Zombie because he's scary, and he does scary movies.
right.
But he's a musician. Yeah, you know, right away, we had a great talk.
So let me ask you this. How do you choose who you want to put in the book?
The truth is I really talk mostly to people who I've authentically been inspired and just moved by in an enormous way, some more than others. But there's no one in the book whose music I don't really respect and love and who hasn't just enriched my life in a huge way. And then there are other of those people who aren't in the book, but for no lack of trying. You know, this has been going on for 30 years. I've been trying certain people. And
the gatekeepers. It just drives me crazy.
Exactly.
It just drives me crazy.
And sometimes you can get beyond them, but if you get those gatekeepers upset, that can backfire in a big way.
Did you ever try for, like, Prince or any of those? You did?
Indeed, I did. Yeah. I couldn't. In fact, he was at a BMI dinner that I went to and sitting right in the front with a young woman, and no one was brave enough to speak to him. To me, of course. So I go up to him and I... Because my pitch was always, I love your music. You know, it's a songwriting magazine. We'll talk only about songwriting, the creative process, music, no personal stuff. No. And he goes, so I said that to him. He goes, yeah, I dig it, man, but no.
Really?
Yeah. But just the fact he said, I dig it, to me was pretty cool.
Right.
But I really
I just
felt
went
sad
to Paisley
that.
Park. I went to Paisley Park and it like took me down the rabbit hole of like... obsessing over all things Prince. So I've been getting all of his guitar pedals. And,
oh, man.
And he's just such a badass.
Talk about a miracle. Just a miracle musician. Just phenomenal.
And he just played everything. I mean, there's few musicians that can play everything that well.
Very few. Stevie Wonder did that. And McCartney can do that. You
I know. And it drives me crazy. I'm like, wait. It's always, when I see a songwriter pick up drums, I get angry. I'm like, you mother. You know, it's just like, because drums are the one,
that's a very difficult instrument
to be good at. You know?
Tom Petty played drums on one of his solo albums, and he said, I can't do it live, but I could do it in the studio. I must say, my friend Neil Rosengarten, who isn't quite as famous as some of these others, but he can play everything, too, and we write songs, and he plays in town. He plays drums and bass and everything, even trumpet, but that's very unusual when someone could do that.
Yeah, there's one guy in Paul Simon's band, I'm sure you know who he is, he plays banjo, cello, guitar, bass, and he plays flute, and he plays saxophone.
Jeez.
And I was just like, and I met him, and I was like, dude, I was like, man, you're just making it like hard for everybody. Like, at that point, it's like, how could you be a master at all of these? You literally mastered all of these instruments. He's like, well, I grew up in the family. Everybody played instruments, and if somebody was playing the bass, you grabbed another instrument. So a lot of that environment was so much
amazing.
Of it. And I'm like, dude, I was not like that. I was like that with food. It was like, if you didn't get your biscuits, you went for the vegetables. You know what I mean? It's like, but people just like, you know, they gravitated toward an instrument so
And that's
easily.
One thing Simon's done is get the greatest musicians in the world he's played with. And it's
Bakiti
pretty nice.
Kamalo.
Yeah, Bakiti on bass is amazing, isn't he? And Vince Nagini was from the Cameroons, who's been playing guitar for, you know.
He does the accordion for him too, I think, right? Who's the accordion player?
Jeez,
he's
such
a badass.
They've had a couple of different people, and I actually know the guy who's forgetting the name right now, unfortunately, because he's great.
Yeah. He's awesome. And he played with Hugh Masekela, and the whole Graceland thing was just crazy.
And you mentioned Steve Gadd. He had Gadd with him for quite a while. And
Gadd was with Clapton. He's one of my favorite drummers as well. Did you get Peter
Steve
Gabriel? Did you ever interview
Peter? I tried
Peter
hard. No, I'd love to. I've just been listening to him a lot. There's certain people like that. You know,
Seems like a hermit.
I can go on that forever. The people I didn't get because it's a source of discontent. Yeah. You know,
that's another book for you. All the people that you didn't.
Right.
How you tried.
That's the third book.
Yeah.
It just makes me a miserable person. I have to concentrate on the good stuff. You know.
Well, let's get to one of your studio tracks. What do you want to play from the studio tracks?
Okay. Well, this is from my first solo album, Orange Avenue. This is called Being in This World, and this is a duet with Art Garfunkel. Because I mentioned I idolized Simon and Garfunkel. My dream was always to get to sing with someone like Art Garfunkel.
Yeah.
And I convinced him to do it. So
I like that you like, I love you, Paul Simon. Get out, because I'm going to do this duet with Garfunkel.
Well, it's not like they were together at the time.
Right,
you know,
right,
you didn't have
right.
to push Paul out.
You know, I saw this
I'd
great,
rather all three of us was together, frankly. I think that would be the best.
I saw
Simon,
this.
Garfunkel, and Zola.
I'm sure you saw this at the Paul Simon exhibit, but there was an SNL sketch where Paul Simon was, you know, meeting all these people. And they're like, you know, I don't know if you remember me. I used to play bass in your band 20 years ago. And he's like, you know, Jeff Stevens, I remember you. You used to have a pink bass. And he was like, yes. And then this girl comes up to him. I don't know if you remember me. I came to the concert in the park. He was like, you coughed 3 times. And I remember you had a little baby girl. Like, and then Art Garfunkel comes up to him. He's like, hey, Paul, you and I were in a group. And he's like, can't place you. So it's just like the guy has a sense of humor. That's what I really
and
love
the two
about.
Of them are like brothers. I mean, they've had famous differences for years. And it's hard for me to see it because I love the two of them so much. And just
they're like
realize.
Family. They're
yeah,
like family.
You think, get over it already. You're Simon and Garfunkel, but they really have a hard time. The first time ever that Simon played on it, he played solo, and then he had Garfunkel came and joined him on a Saturday Night Live, and the first thing Simon said to him was, oh, so you've come crawling back, huh?
Oh, man.
I mean, they're tough with each other.
All right, well, you know what? I like that you took his place for now. So what's the name of the song one more time?
It's called Being in This World.
All right, let's hear it.
Virgin Mary Blue. He walks along a rattle hole. The snow is falling all around. He's pitching to DiMaggio. Being in this world. Being in this world. Sharpen knives from town to town. Whetstone wheels drive to his back. Walnuts in his wrinkled hands. Fish lures in his crumpled hat. Pockets all full of sunflower seeds. He was happier with no more than that to be. Everybody in their own time, everybody in their own space. It takes dreams and prayers and wine to run this human race. His mother had a rosary. His father come home drunk again. They shared each other's company. Just like a burrow and a hen. His father breaking fence again, his mother quiet in the dark, while all the sons are fishermen. Wait for his day at Fenway Park. Being in this world, being in this world, being in this world, being in this world, being in this world.
Nice, very nice.
Woo.
Very cool, very cool.
Yeah.
I was like, Josh, you swimming over there?
Sound effects.
It made Josh wet. you know what? It was really cool. I love the fretless bass in that track.
Talking about Bakiti Kumal, I was inspired by that. I love that fretless stuff.
Yeah, it's awesome. It just had so much personality,
too.
I'm
glad you like that.
Harmonies are great. That must have been very surreal.
Some people don't like when you mix bass too loud. So
oh, dude, that's like the most important instrument in a band for me. So, like, let's turn it up. That must have been pretty surreal for you to, like, work with Art Garfunkel.
It was. It was really magical. You know, it's one thing to interview these people, but to play music with them is a whole other trip for me, especially my own song, my own recording. And he came to Hollywood, a studio right on Hollywood Boulevard where I was working. And, you know, he could have just come in and done one chorus, and we could have flown that to every chorus, and that would have been fine.
Yeah.
But he did every chorus differently. He spent a long time learning my phrasing. He spent hours to get it right, and he didn't have
to do that. That's a true artist. Yeah. You know, when you see people like that, it's so refreshing. It's like, man, thank God, because awesome. you don't always meet those people, like, especially when they're at a level where they don't need to be like that, and you know this, when you still see them wanting to put in the work, it's refreshing, because it just makes you inspired.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Put forth that effort.
Yeah.
And it was cool, his engineer came first and brought a special lamp, like Artie has to have this lamp, and got the reverb just right, you know, before Artie even got there. It's like a ton of reverb he wanted to hear while singing, so it was cool to see how he did it.
That's awesome.
And for the first long time, he just did unison with me. And I was thinking, yeah, that's good, but kind of hoping for harmony, you know? And he's like, I know, I just have to learn your phrasing. And he learned mine perfectly and then did his. And
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was great to watch.
That's cool. What was I going to ask you? Did you record it to tape or digital?
This was tape.
Yeah, it sounds warm. Yeah. Especially, you really hear the warmth in on a fretless bass, like with that kind of attack.
Yeah, there's a presence.
There's a presence, and it just sounds warm. That's why I was like, man, if you record this on digital, I gotta ask him what he's
using.
Yeah,
studio's not there anymore. 24 track. It was called Boulevard Sound in Hollywood, and a big studio. They used to do big bands there, and I love that place. And
I still record to tape, so I'm a huge fan.
Yeah,
nobody really does that anymore.
You can't beat it.
You can't beat it. It's and you know what? To anybody else, it's just like this marginal of difference, but this marginal difference is everything to a musician. You know, it's like that little bit of room, is everything.
I mean, the anniversary of Sgt. Pepper, it's caused so many people to listen to it, and I've done a lot of writing, and so much of the presence of those instruments is that. It's analog.
Yeah.
And there's only four tracks, so those are big tracks.
Well, that's one of the coolest things about recording a tape. You're limited with the amount of tracks you have, so it's like you don't have any superfluous ideas. It's like, okay, let's put the ideas that count, and then let's learn to mix them, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about Brian Wilson, because he was a total hermit, a recluse, if you will. Tell me how that interview came about and how that went
about. I've interviewed Brian a few times. The very first time I interviewed him is when he was with Dr. Landy, who got him off drugs and got him to lose a lot of weight, but with kind of a brutal regimen that Brian had to live through. It was tough for him. And so my first interview was in Landy's office with Brian lying on the couch, like I was the doctor, and Landy's assistants also taping it. And it was a little questionable because Landy was co-writing songs with him and Landy's girlfriend and getting his, you know, writing credit. And And Landy said to me, I will only do the, you can only talk to Brian as if you interview me too and print it. And he thought I was going to screw him, and I did. We printed it. It was the magazine Song Talk I ran. And a couple of years later, he says, you know, you were the only guy in the press that actually did what you promised me. But so Brian then was pretty uncomfortable. But since then, I've interviewed him more recently, and he's happier now. He's with his wife, and we always meet near his home off of Mulholland. And he's the kind of guy, if you talk about anything non-musical, there's nothing, no words. But if you talk about music, he'll open up. Hmm. And he, you know, he is a genius with music. He didn't write lyrics. He's very musical. So I did something that I sometimes do with people, because you're a musician. Some songwriters have colors associated with keys from working with keys for so often.
Yeah.
Some famous classical composers did that as well. And so some songwriters have specific colors. Others say, no, they don't at all. But Brian said, yeah, he did. And he gave me colors for all the major keys, like red, E major was red, G was brown. So then I asked him about the minor keys. I like, how about A minor? Black. B minor? Black. C minor? Black. I said, Brian, are all the minor keys black to you? He said, yes, they are.
Really?
Yeah.
And I thought that was so, because they're dark?
Is yeah, that and Brian has got a real fear of darkness. His whole thing has been writing sunny music about the beach. He never surfed, and he wrote all the surf songs. And he was a guy, you know, who's, you know, he was abused by his father. A lot of darkness and, you know, problems. And kind of pressured to write sunny music. So I think he's scared of a darkness. And he's never written a song that's really in a minor key. God only knows, it's kind of major minor, but he doesn't just write in a normal minor key. He mostly writes in major keys.
Well, I like how he does, like, he works a lot with suspensions, which is crazy. Like, he'll do with vocal arrangements, or he'll do with, like, guitar parts. And that's, like, the magic of, like, how he makes, you know, these, like, lush choruses and beautiful sounding things over some minor chords, but like the minor chords, he definitely likes to just, you know, kind of move into the major. He likes to to keep it.
He'll use minor chords, but be in a major key. He'll go to minor chords, but he's rarely written a whole song in a minor key. But that's absolutely true. And though, I mean, he was an amazing producer, as well as he was the guy arranging and producing those, and his drum parts and all of it were so unusual. He didn't do anything normal.
Yeah, that's what we need, though. We need somebody taking risks like that.
Right, and he knew exactly what he wanted, and he heard it in his head, and if it took several studios, like Good Vibrations, took what at the time was a fortune to spend, you know.
Right.
And many different studios, and people thought he just went crazy. And to us, it was such good-sounding, happy music. When I asked Brian about Good Vibrations, he said it sounds kind of frightening to him. It's kind of a monster that got kind of, you know, bigger than he
Well, it's haunting. It's hauntingly beautiful. That's what Pet Sounds is kind of like that for me, you know, like the whole record's like that. But that's what made it like such a like pinnacle of success. But it didn't really have the success. It was like a slow burn. It didn't have the success right away. So it's now touted as one of the best records, but it didn't really get the reviews when it first came out, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because it wasn't the sunny disposition.
Right, it didn't have the big, you know, Beach Boy hits like some of the others, but a song like God Only Knows, as you said, I mean, the composition of those chords is just miraculous. As a songwriter, I can look at those chords and I don't even see how he got there, you know?
Right.
Other songs you can see, oh yeah, that makes sense. You know, from the 1 to the 4 and then the 6.
Yeah.
Brian is like, it's, you know, it's just genius. And I, you know, I play God Only Knows on the piano, and it's kind of like playing Steely Dan or something like that, where it's just out of our whole box of normal,
I mean,
you know,
sounds
composition
like
rules.
On the spectrum, almost, you're saying about like the colors and stuff. Like, that's what a lot of like, you know, kids on the spectrum, when they can start playing music early, they see all the colors and think of these weird combinations.
Yeah, it's called synesthesia.
Yeah, we lose that as we get older. Yeah, synesthesia, that's right.
Hendrix had it clearly, and I've always had that since I was a kid. I just never thought there was anything to it, but it was always interesting. Like, do other people have the same colors?
Right.
And sometimes they do, but generally not.
Yeah, generally
they have different colors.
I think it's like, I think life experience has a lot to do with their perception. John Mayer actually has it.
Is that right?
He says he has a slight case of it. It's nothing crazy, but it's
amazing.
I think
the instrument affects that, too.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Are you going to write a third book? I think everybody's wondering that.
Well, I'm working on many other books, but I don't know if there'll be a third version of this, but I might expand this one again.
Man, I think you should, because, man, you got so many stories. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. I'd like to do. There are many great songwriters I don't have, and there's others that I probably should get that I don't even know about. So,
Paul, you have been a wonderful guest. Where can people find you if they want to order your book, if they want to download your music? Where can people find you?
My website is called Blue Railroad. It's a website of the arts called BlueRailroad.com, so you can find me there. And a lot of the interviews I do for magazines, I have to make them so short. So I put the whole long thing on Blue Railroad and ultimately in my books. And you can also find me on Facebook and YouTube.
Well, I'll be going on Blue Railroad just to look at all those songwriting articles because, man, you've been a fascinating interview.
Thank you. Thanks for
having
me.
And I would definitely want to have you back. I could sit here and talk. I just got the cue, and I'm like,
I feel like we didn't even hear anything.
I know.
I mean, it seems like there's so many more stories to hear.
I'll tell you, these are my favorite interviews where it's like, man, we're out of time already. It feels like 5 minutes, and it's like, that drives me crazy. But, Paul, I want you to come back. So
I'd love to.
I'm
going to
have you back, and I want more stories. And thank you for just lending us your time and so much, you know, musical expertise. It's really been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Nikki, very much. Thank you, Josh. I'm glad you were
here.
Yeah,
definitely. Thank you.
A lot of fun. Thanks. I'd love to come back. Thanks.
That's right. All right, guys. Well, on behalf of Josh and myself, we'll see you guys next week. Thanks to Paul Zolo, and we'll definitely have him back. We'll see you guys next week.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Korula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.